and welcome to AFP. My name is Devang Desai, and I'm joined by the usual suspects, David Goss and Nick Andrade. On today's show, we chat big problems for TFC, UCL, and UEL, recaps of those finals, an international break preview, and of course, it's your questions on Ask AFP. Gentlemen, how are we doing? I'll be honest, I'm not doing well. I don't think I'm going to watch hockey for a long, long time. But
yep.
How was your weekend, David? How are the Knicks doing?
I love Devang. I'll start the show with asking how you're doing, but I'll then preempt that by telling you I'm sad, so don't be happy in my face and be an asshole, is how I read that.
I think you read it well, sir. Read the room is one of those things that people do. And I'm crestfallen.
I'll come on to your level, Devang. I've covered sports professionally for like 10 years now. I don't really root for a lot of teams or like stan a lot of teams anymore. Like, I'm a fan of what I believe in and I'll root for that and storylines and different things like that. The two teams I would say I still am a fan of are the New York Knicks, who are my number one team, and the U.S. men's national team. And they lost at the same time on Sunday afternoon. They were playing simultaneously and they both lost. So I'm with you, Devang. I got you.
It was like as if Granit Xhaka dunked on Julius Randle in some weird way as he lost to Switzerland. Could you say that's fair?
Sort of, although let's be real. There's zero chance Granit Xhaka can dunk.
It's true. It's true. Facts are facts. Nick, you share the Leafs heartbreak. How are you doing?
I do. I'm not doing too well. I woke up this morning pretty miserable. I've been scrolling Twitter for probably the last, 16 hours just to try to feel something. It's not really working. But at the same time, I'm pretty, most of my life, most of my teams that I cheered for were losers. But Liverpool, Portugal, the Raptors, they all won recently. So that's pretty good. But I have to say,
God damn it, Nick. I have seen zero teams I root for win a championship. And you're going to give me a sob story about how your teams are losers while they win trophies left and right.
I've seen the U.S. men's national team qualify for the World Cup numerous times. Okay. So there's a little bit of joy in that.
Yeah. There's a ton of joy, but we don't get a trophy.
But I think what we relate with, especially like maybe the Knicks and the Leafs, the same thing is like we would almost die for a championship, right? Like if that happened, we would all probably sob and cry for both the Knicks and the Leafs. So, every team that I've cheered for has almost won something now, which is great. But if the Leafs won, that would top everything. And because they haven't, and they haven't even won a round, pretty miserable. Right, DeBang?
Dylan, I want you to clip this out. In 14 years, when a wily veteran and RJ Barrett leads the Knicks to a championship, I'm going to play this for Nick. And if he doesn't cry, because he just committed to crying for both the Knicks and the Leafs, then I'm going to call him a fraud.
One thing's for sure, there is no God. I think we can confirm that based on the last few days. No, well said, Nick. And all, it all levels out in the end. I think TFC winning was one of those big, like, hey, if they could win, anyone could. And time management, I'm probably never watching a Leaf regular season game again based on
what I said this
year. So yep. We'll get some time back and perhaps live our lives in a better way. And now, though there's a huge international break, TFC does take center stage with the Jays in Toronto, which is kind of bad news, as we'll get to based on what is happening with the club. But before we do that, a reminder, we are on patreon.com/yourfootballpodcast. You join there, you get the show early. When we record it, right after that, basically, you get it ad free and you get to jump on the Discord where we're chatting footy all the time. There was some Leaf therapy in there as well. Thanks to the kind souls in the Discord, but it's a fun time. So I would recommend heading on over there and joining us. All right. After the break, we return with, a recap of what is going down in TFC land.
Now the crew sprint to open real estate, up 71. Sardes! What a ball from Santos! 50 in all competitions and fourth alone in club history. GZ, it's 2-0.
Welcome back to AFP. David, I mentioned the Leafs off the top of the show, but they're gone. They're done now. There are a couple teams still playing. in the six, the Blue Jays, and of course Toronto FC, but all is not well in TFC land. We'll get to the loss on the field to a resurgent, possibly Columbus Crew, but obviously the huge news this week is the Jozy Altidore situation, the falling out with Chris Armas following his substitution against Orlando, and that loss has led to Jozy trading away from the team and probably never returning based on the quotes we've heard, and Ali Curtis saying that they're going to try and figure something out during the international break. But Josie's gone. Jefferson Soteldo was hurt, but no one really knew how hurt until the Venezuelan FA said how hurt on Friday, which was super weird. You had that going on, and the team is off to its worst start in a long time, I think since 2012. So if you add everything together, it paints a pretty bleak picture. And I guess, DG, I start with the Jozy stuff. Like, I think if you're coming at it from a TFC lens, you've got a club legend going to battle with the club. And in this sense, no one really wins. It's all bad.
Yeah, and it kind of bubbled up, what, 2 years ago when his contract was coming up, of like, how does this relationship end and what's the plan? And they re-signed him to an extended deal and felt like he could still be a useful part of the group. And he has talked pretty heavily about his commitment to what Toronto was building and not just winning one title, but wanting to build something long term. I actually was sitting with him and he said that to me going into the 2017 final, I think it was, where I was like, well, what if you lose more? He's like, it doesn't matter. It's not about one game. This was about like building up a club and doing something different. So he was pretty committed to that, but there's just been so much off and on over the years, right? Of upset about the trainer and injuries and different reports coming out of this is what the club's saying, what's going on. This is what his camp is saying, what's going on. And so it just has been a bit of a mess for a while. And it felt like if that's how it operates at, then this is how it was going to end. And it's unfortunate because I love him as a player and I still respect him a ton as a person. I think he's a huge positive influence over the game. I know in the US, I think in Canada as well, especially with a lot of these young guys. So it's unfortunate to watch it go down like this, Devang. And I don't know how it like works out for Toronto, right? They're not going to be a better team without having Jozy available to them for the rest of the year. But at some point at the same time, if you think it's detrimental to your club, then you have to move on, I guess, is the decision that they make.
For sure. And I think you could argue the merits of the argument Jozy was having about being taken off and then his record the last few years and his injury problems. I think those are all fair to mention. But I think forgetting Altidore's status on that club is a mistake as well. And if you're looking at this as like a PR thing, I don't think Chris Armas is going to win this PR battle, especially with what's going on the field. And I think there was a quote post-match from the Columbus game where he's talking about Pep Guardiola and where Aro is playing, and it's all a little bit disjointed. And I'm like, did Man City just lost? There was also playing at the same time. It was also weird. And I thought in terms of stock and like who's falling and who's rising, Armas' stock is pretty damn low right now. And we're not very far into the season. And I had this concern, I guess you could say, but I'm not going to pretend like I didn't think this is a wise move maybe a few months ago. But I think the early results have clearly shown that this is not going particularly well right now. That being said, Pozuelo came back for 30 minutes. You're still getting your squad together. Like, it's such an impossible read, really, at this juncture of the season, because like, what do you do if you say, no, Josie's in the right and we've got to stick with him? Do you ditch Armas? Like, that is the question we're asking now. So it kind of seems like they've painted themselves in the corner in terms of the roster decision.
Well, it was clear that they were trying to move Jozy in the offseason and it wasn't possible. Like, he has a no trade clause. He is a pretty substantial salary earner in MLS. So it was like, you need another team to be willing to come out and get him, and then you need him to be willing to go there. It didn't happen. And so then they reintegrated him back into this team. I don't know that you could do that a second time, even if you get rid of Armas.
Yeah.
I still think the damage that's been done, like culturally, I don't know that you can bring him back into the team and just move on from there. So whether you're keeping Armas around or not, which I'd be shocked if you got rid of a coach this quickly into a season, especially as you said, like Pasuelo hasn't played yet. And Soteldo's gotten a few minutes and now he's hurt, but he should be back based off the timeline of the injury pretty quickly after this international break, which, okay, that's quote unquote fortunate for TFC that that's when it happens. I just don't know that you can bring a player like that back in. So then you kind of have no choice but to move on. And Chris Armas has been around MLS for a ton, super successful player, really successful assistant coach. One of the things that happened with him as a coach was he kind of ended up in these battles, like mentally on his own, where he was arguing these points and kind of obsessing over the coverage of the team and the way people talked about it and stuff like that. And that's what you saw in that quote you mentioned about Pep. And it felt like it was the middle of 2018 again, or 2019 with Red Bulls, where he's talking about, well, we outpossessed this team on this day for this 15-minute segment, but no one talks about it and stuff like that, where it all kind of gets convoluted, as you said. And then I think you're losing like a stability there because there's not that leadership. There's not that trust from the front. And a lot of this is all of the worries that you had coming into the season, I think, and a lot of fans. And I think a lot of it's now come to fruition.
So, I mean, things are pretty shitty if you're in Toronto and if you cheer for these teams. But if you're in Montreal, you have to be loving life right now. The Habs have won, of course, and CF Montreal won as well over the weekend. Mason Toy returning from injury. All he does is score huge goals, David. And, you know, when I watch this team, that's basically what they're really lacking. I think that killer instinct in the final third, because overall, you have to really like what you've seen from Wilfred Nancy, and that contract extension that he was given for next season is in as an indicator of that. But I think if you have some better finishing from guys like Romel Quioto, like, we're looking at Montreal even being higher up in the standings. But it's an important win. It's a win they should have. I don't think Chicago is a particularly great team, and going there at Soldier Field does offer some challenges to the opponent, but I think Montreal did well to escape with 3 points and firmly in the playoff conversation.
I agree with you, Devang. And this Montreal team, as you said it, but I think we should key in on, they'd be second in the Eastern Conference if Romel Quioto finished that sitter against FC Cincinnati, who are the worst team and they should have beaten anyway. But they would be second in the East, having not played at home, of course, living in Orlando under a new coach. And Mason Toy has 3 goals in 3 games, but has only played 3 games because of injury. So a ton of good stuff has happened for this Montreal team. One of the things that stands out to me is Rudy Camacho was barely playable last year. Joel Waterman's been good in spots this year, coming up from CPL 2 years ago. And Kiki Struna was a huge struggle at Houston last year. And Nance has put them in a spot to succeed, where again, we come back to MLS coaches barely have an excuse with their rosters. If Nance can get these performances out of these guys that were basically rejects from a bunch of other MLS coaches. And then the rest of the teams come around together. Now, they got pretty much killed in the XG expectations in this game, but I think most of what Chicago did was in front of this team, outside of the big chance for Fabian Herbers. And then the goal in the 96th that gets called back. And then you look at, for Montreal, Mason Toy, I think he brings something different than the other 18 strikers on this roster. And that's why he's so important, because I think him and Johnson are going to fit together beautifully. And Johnson's ability to create for him and connect with him up top. Hurtado as well does a ton of running that maybe Mason Toy doesn't do a lot. But the goal Toy scores to win this one off the bench is a pure striker goal, right? It's that half step back between the two center backs and then just nodded on with the momentum of the ball into the far post rather than trying to do too much. And he has these goal scoring instincts no one else has. And if he can do that in the way Mihailovic is playing and what they're starting to get from the different options up wing back, this team's getting better. And I love that Nance gets the extension for the contract because, okay, maybe he's not your guy for the next 10 years, but now you could build. And this is a club that hasn't really had a future to build to except for about 5 months of excitement around Henri. And now you can look at, okay, how is he playing? What type of players do we want? Let's go talk to players who want to play for this coach. And that's pretty exciting for Montreal.
My Robert Berich golden boot pick is not looking good at all.
I was high on that one too. Just everything about it seemed right. The team still felt like they'd create chances. He actually had a really good run to open up that play for Herbers. But Chicago, it's a bit of a mess.
Not good.
I mean, it could have been 2-0 Montreal purely based off Chicago mistakes. They gave the ball away in the third minute for a breakaway for Montreal and did it again late in the game. So off that alone, and that would have been Montreal doing nothing to create those chances. And Chicago just continues to do that.
Speaking of not great and quite bad, Inter Miami is in a bad, bad way on the field. They lost again on the weekend to DC United very handily. I think you're Gonzalo Higuain and Federico Higuain, sure, but like it's not looking very good. And then you have the huge sanctions announced by MLS regarding the Blaise Matuidi signing. The penalties include a $2 million fine to the club and a $250,000 fine to managing owner Jorge Mas. Paul McDonough, who was Inter Miami's COO and sporting director at the time of the infractions, has been suspended for 2 years, basically, and he ended up leaving Atlanta, leaving another club in shambles. But, I mean, I hear me out, David. I wonder if I'm a mark here or if they got me, but it's the one of the signature clubs of the league in terms of who's involved and the friendships with Don Garber, etc. But to see this penalty handed out is kind of comforting that Inter Miami wasn't allowed to get away with it, even though it seemed pretty obvious that something illegal had happened. But I wonder what kickstarted this investigation. Like, I think it took a while to come down with the punishment, but it's a fascinating thing to consider from beginning to end. And we end with this huge penalty and a huge ramifications for the club going forward.
Yeah, and I don't know. You look at the history of MLS, zero chances the first time this happened, right? I think Zlatan came into this league as a TAM player. Like, this is the, there's no chance that this is the first time something like this happens, which is what's fascinating about, like, the fact that there was this investigation. But I think once you came out and publicly said you were going to investigate it, you had to have a strong punishment, but you don't want to ruin the franchise 2 years in. And I think I agree with you in that. I thought they handled this right. Like, this is a serious punishment. It is a serious way to say to clubs, this won't be accepted going forward. But at the same time, I don't think it's overdone. And I do appreciate the fact that Paul McDonough wasn't allowed to just leave the club and have this happen. Like, if this was under his watch or his responsibility, then he also had to be punished. And so I think they did it the right way. It's great that it came out on Friday afternoon of Memorial Day weekend. That's a classic news dump right there, right in garbage time. But I agree with you. I think this was kind of what the league had to do if they found that the facts that they're investigating, you know, connected to the story that they thought it was going to be, which clearly is what happened.
So MLS is done for a bit. DG, we got a pretty sizable break. Your American Yanks have already played in preparation for their Nations League games. I think a pretty Euro-heavy roster. Saw Jackson Ewell in there, but a loss to Switzerland in Switzerland. What was your kind of takeaway from that one?
So I actually thought we were really good in the first half when it was, you know, it's as friendly, you get six subs, things get chaotic. I thought we were really good in the first half. We obviously pressed Switzerland into a couple mistakes. Legette gets that early goal when we just have a bunch of bodies in the box. And there was a lot that I liked from this U.S. national team. I think Tyler Adams, the least replaceable player on the roster. I actually also think just purely for what he does compared to other players at his position in the world, I actually think he's the highest potential or best national team player. I don't know if that's right. Obviously, Pulisic's going to get a lot of that praise. But I just think Tyler's a world-class player at counter-pressing, closing space, reading the game, all those things at that position. Clearly, we missed that. And so I think the conversation of how do we play without him, because he is hurt pretty often and we're not going to have him every game, has to continue for Greg Berhalter. But at the same time, you're trying to high press as a cohesive unit with a group that's never played together before. And unfortunately, we still have to say that. I was hoping that the course of the next week and a half was, okay, I don't got to couch these things for everyone, because you guys watch this game, or, you know, you look at the score, you understand what's going on. The average fan, I'm not even going to say soccer fan, doesn't. And so we've had 3 years of, oh, well, it's a young group. Oh, well, they haven't been together. Oh, well, we didn't have the proper cycle. Oh, and like fans are like, I don't care, which I understand. I was hoping to not have to do that anymore. That's clearly not been made evident by this result in this game. But we got pulled apart a few times. The goal that Switzerland scores was a huge breakdown on the press. Press is something that's going to take time to like be a solid unit as a group. But we have a ton of talent. And I think that they played in a way that I was like proud of. Like, I think they felt comfortable trying to break down Switzerland the few times they had opportunities to do it. I think we were aggressive in transition. And we could have won that game. We could have been up 2 or 3 goals before, you know, they go up 2-1. So I thought it was overall a good day for the U.S. And the point of it was to play this game so that the players have a weekend game and that the medical team and the physical team can get an idea of, okay, when we, our players in Europe have this weekend game, how are they going to physically react when we then fly them to the Americas for CONCACAF World Cup qualifying that Thursday? So that's kind of was the point of all of this. It wasn't actually the result and the matchup, which you're never going to waste the game when you have so few. But we've got Honduras on Thursday, which I think is going to be a tough matchup because we pressed Switzerland because Switzerland wants to play out of the back. Honduras has no love for that and they don't care about that. Now, there's a Honduras group that hasn't really been together the last 2 years as well because of COVID. So I think it's going to be a whole different challenge for the U.S., but that's what CONCACAF World Cup qualifying is, right? It's so different home yeah. away, and it's so different across the different opponents. That's what this team, this group needs to be capable of playing in.
Speaking of CONCACAF qualifying, while you fancy boys are gallivanting around Europe, we are mired in the Canadian qualifiers, Aruba coming up on Saturday, and then Suriname, which is a really big one, the next Tuesday. The squad was announced this week. I think a few surprises, T.V. Hutchinson not fit yeah. to join up with the team, but you have pretty much the guys you want outside of that, and then the added wrinkle of having a squad training up in Florida that's not involved in these qualifiers. That includes the likes of Joel Waterman, who you mentioned, but also Ayo Akinola and Luke Singh, two players who have been linked to representing other nations. Luke Singh was called up by Trinidad days ago, so I don't know exactly what's happening. But I saw Pat on the Discord was saying this is probably Gold Cup related in terms of getting these guys ready. Tesho, Jaquil Marshall
ready.
Can Luke
Singh play for Trinidad and World Cup qualifying and then play for Canada in a Gold Cup? I don't think so.
At this point in the game, I don't put anything past FIFA and CONCACAF, but this does seem problematic to me.
I guess I would say this. My understanding is if Luke Singh already has both passports, he can make his one-time switch if he were to switch later. Right. It would be odd as an 18-year-old to debut for one country and then make your one-time switch a week later.
And perhaps this camp is just like, hey, here's where we see you going forward, and we desperately need center back so badly, so please, Luke, play for Canada. And that's the conversation. But it'll be an exciting time.
Yeah, positive to see on the roster, Daniel Henry back in. I think he's the best center back in the pool. Obviously, a loss to not have Atiba. And I think if he's healthy, he's a part of the team. If he's healthy, he's playing. If he wants to come, he's playing. So clearly, he was not, you know, eligible for the team. I saw people responding, where is Atiba? It's like, where do you think he is? Yeah, if Atiba wants to come, he's coming. And obviously, Kamal Miller still dealing with an injury, which is frustrating to me because I think he's played well for Montreal, and I thought the Montreal move was, okay, he needs to establish himself as a starting center back for the Canadian national team, not available for the biggest game, I don't know, of the last 10 years, maybe the biggest game go up until 2026. Like, beating Suriname is everything. I am putting Canada past Aruba already. I cover a ton of CONCACAF. I watch a ton of CONCACAF. This is not me disrespecting CONCACAF. This is the reality of where these two teams stand, especially after the performance against the Cayman Islands, which is a fairly similar opponent for Canada. So they should take care of work. We will be back next week with pretty extensive coverage of Suriname versus the Canadian national team. This is a loaded Suriname squad, but they've never really played together. So it's going to be a fascinating week coming up. But I already feel nervous about this game because there's just no safety net, right? It's just this one game. That's it.
Please, this is way too soon after one of the most traumatic, similar circumstances of that. But you're right. I just want people to recognize we had a David guarantee of the Aruba result. So send
you can blame
the positive. Exactly. Can't wait. Exciting times international footy we're going to be covering extensively over the next few weeks.
I love it.
I'm loving it. Also, a famous slogan that we're going to steal. Euros, CONCACAF, lots of fun coming up. After the break. Copa America, grimace emoji. What are they doing? But we'll talk about that as well in a few minutes. Coming up after the break, though, Chelsea does the damn thing in the Champions League final, and Unai Emery is the damn man. Coming up next on AFP.
Ederson off his line. Havertz! Chelsea in front. Kai Havertz, with his first ever goal in the Champions League, has made the breakthrough.
Welcome back to a football podcast. Kai Havertz, the golden gun, the German kid come good. Timo Werner, forget football outside of the box. Football inside of the box. Outside of the box, fantastic. Does everything you need. Thomas Tuchel, what a job. Chelsea 1, Manchester City 0. Pep Guardiola's Champions League dreams dashed once again, David. I mean, I'm curious what you thought of the game overall, because I was a little surprised to see the positive discourse surrounding it. And like, Mason Mount was fantastic and N'Golo Kanté was fantastic. Don't get me wrong, but I was a bit surprised to see people raving about how good the game was. And I'm curious what you thought about it.
Yeah, I was a little surprised about that too. I think people felt like it was a more open final than you normally see, because finals can be so stodgy, teams are scared to lose. But in the end, I think City had an expected goal, an XG of 0.45. Like, there was not opportunities in this game for these two teams. So I kind of sat in the middle. Now, coming off the Europa League final, I was like, oh, this is 1,000 times better, because I don't know if they played soccer for most of that game. This one had that. So I kind of understood it, but I wasn't in the same camp. The thing that not frustrating, I'm not a fan of either of these teams, so I don't really care. But the thing that I felt in watching the game was it was so similar to the last two Chelsea wins, which we've just seen. They were both 1-0, that it felt slightly inevitable to me. So some of the drama, personally, I think was taken out, because I was like, I already know how this ends. Chelsea scored. They can sit in a block pretty comfortably. Man City's going to lose their head. Man City's going to try and create all these chances and just put in crosses. And that's exactly what happened.
And that feeling was cemented by Pep playing with no DM and like kind of doing something weird like he has to for no discernible reason, and maybe getting outchessed by TT, because I think it's pretty clear now he has something on Guardiola, which not many managers have. He beat him 3 times this season. Like, that's pretty nuts considering how good Man City was during the year. Congrats to Christian Pulisic for becoming the second North American to lift the Champions League trophy. Is that true, or am I getting that wrong?
I don't think so, because I think Rafa Marquez has won it, and I think Mexico is North America.
Damn it.
Yeah, Mexico's North America. Those are the only 3 countries in North America.
I was just trying to talk shit about David in the notes. It didn't work.
I retract the barb, but I still maintain it.
Nice. We're a small growing soccer nation just trying to follow the big dogs up north. We just one day want to be as good as the Alphonso Davies and Atiba Hutchinsons of the world. And that's we only had 2 players in this final. So,
that's a huge it's pretty damn cool. And again, taking away the
interest
and all that. Right.
By the way,
but like just to see North Americans consistently in matches like this, pretty damn cool. And it is a overall good sign. I was curious, though. I'll open it up to the room. Who do you think is the best player on Chelsea? Because I think you can make a big, big shout for Mason Mount after the year he had. And for some insane way, he's perhaps even a bit underrated for being English and playing for Chelsea and Frank Lampard's prodigal son. I think I underestimated how good he was, and he really showed out the entire year, but it was a pretty nice crowning performance in the final.
I said this to someone on Sunday. I was like, he's underrated. They go, really? He's rated pretty highly. I was like, now? But like 4 months ago, he was like a meme player. Where it was like, well, he only plays because of Lampard and he's his son. Right. And everyone turns the page. I'm fascinated by it. I'm fine with it. Turns the page so quickly where it's like, well, everyone knows Mount has to start for England. He's the center of the England team. And it's like, no, I'm pretty sure he was like the reason people wanted to fire Lampard, and he ended up being the best player on the team under a second coach. Conte's clearly the best player on this team, but I think Mount's definitely a shout up there for that, and had a good game in this one. The game-winning play, right? The goal to Havertz. It's a beautiful pass. It's a fairly simple pass. Like, he hits it on the ground 40 yards and there's no one in the path. And I actually think Chilwell is the one who creates the opening with the layoff off the goal kick into Mount's feet. And I thought Chilwell was unbelievable in this game. I think I put in the Discord, I thought he was man of the match. He had one or two huge clearances on the back post. He was clean in possession. He was getting into the attack. He was really good. He loves to play Man City. It should be one of those where it's like, he's the Byron Russell. He's available for loan just to play against Man City and just goes around the league and does that for every team. So that was really impressive. Impressive win for Chelsea. Second time they've won Champions League. It's the second time they've done it with a manager who took over midseason after they fired another manager. So I would just assume for everyone at Chelsea, sign like an 8-year contract, because you know you're going to get fired a year and a half in, just so they can win Champions League.
Tony Rudiger was great. That really good Players Tribune article he penned or co-penned about growing up in Berlin and his story. I thought that was a really good read. And shouts to Andreas Christensen as well. I think he came in just before halftime, but you're replacing Thiago Silva at the back. Pretty big job. Did quite fine. It's people ragged on Chelsea for the transfer. Not maybe they didn't rag on them, but it's like, oh, you spent this much money on Timo Werner and Kai Havertz, and like, what do you have to show for it? But overall, they did fantastic transfer business. Like, Edouard Mendy was terrific. One of the best keepers in the world. Ben Chilwell, I mean, I think you have to get it right when you're buying within England because you're paying a crazy premium, but they did. They got it exactly right. And Reece James is going to be a player for many years to come. Like, it's worked out pretty damn well for them. And I mean, say what you will about them, it seems to work pretty damn well.
Agreed. And I would say there's also a piece in this, like, Jorginho was so key to what Sarri wanted to do. And he was unbelievable at Napoli under Sarri. They were able to, Tuchel was able to like recreate him and keep him in the team and make him super useful to this group. So it's not just going out and signing new players. It's also they've resurrected some of the pieces that were in the team, and you hope they can do the same with Timo Werner. I don't know if that's the case. He's always been a mystery to me. Like, going into 2018 World Cup, I was like, okay, so Germany now has a center forward. And then he just looked so uncomfortable that entire tournament. And he's done the same with Chelsea. So he's basically only played well for Leipzig, who play a fairly specific way, and it was built around him and he grew up in it. So it's questionable with him. But for everyone else, I think you can kind of have confidence that they're going to be put into the team. I don't want to toot my own horn here, but I just want to throw out, I'm pretty sure I spent 3 weeks screaming about Rudiger when we started the season. And like the transfer rumors were around where I was like, why is this not just the guy? Why are you going out and signing other guys? So I was glad to see the masked man get the opportunity and step up and have a big game.
Do you think he still needed the mask, or is this now become like a life,
Rip Hamilton?
A thing he's taken on? He's taken it on as a new thing. I like it. Hey, it's working.
Yeah, I'm here for it. It looks more comfortable than the full face yeah. ones people wear. Yeah.
So for the purists and the true footy fan, the real good final was the Europa League final. Unai Emery and Villarreal stunning Manchester United in penalty kicks, where everyone scored except David De Gea, which kind of sucks. if you want to be neutral about it and feel compassion for people, I felt really bad for David De Gea. I'm like, God damn, that sucks. But as a hater, and don't get me wrong, that's what I am first and foremost. Hook that to my veins. It was a fantastic end and a bit weirdly cathartic for me seeing Unai win again. This trophy, this competition that he's so good at, the one place he couldn't win with at Arsenal is it's poetic. I don't know. I don't know what else to say.
Devang, I have a question for you. Do you, seeing Unai Emery win, does that make it worse or better?
I felt like I evolved a bit as a person because I literally have no ill will at all towards Unai. Okay. And like, genuinely happy for him. And like, Santi Cazorla was there and Coughlin's there. And like, there's these weird links. And like, Kapui was there. We had like the Spurs, the Arsenal representation in this ragtag midfield that somehow won a trophy. Like, a lot of cool, good stories that I could support. So no ill will at all. And like, listen, I think Unai Emery is not a bad manager, clearly. It was not going to work at Arsenal, and I think they had to make a change. But to pin everything post Wenger on Unai is very stupid. And I'm glad people are seeing he's a good manager.
And I thought Man U didn't deserve to win this, right? Like, Villarreal came out, they get the goal, they have a game plan of how they want to play, even with guys gushing blood from their face, which was absurd. And they've played good soccer all tournament, and they've played within themselves. And so, yeah, I agree. I was glad to see them win. When you watch a PK shootout like this, a penalty kick shootout, whatever you want to call it, you wonder, like, why isn't every shot going in with other ones, right? Because you'll watch a shootout where a team will win 3-0. And then you'll watch another one that goes to 7 that everyone scores.
Villarreal took some of the best penalties I've seen in a situation like that. The keeper, top keys, top corner, unstoppable.
And I think keepers should be good at penalties because they shoot them all the time on each other. But I would never blame a keeper for missing a penalty on the game. Like, he can't come out of this and say David De Gea lost this final. His team was incapable of scoring against the low block for 120 minutes. And then, okay, no one misses a penalty and he misses. But I don't know that you walk away from that and you're like, well, he's not the starter anymore because he didn't score a penalty kick in this final as the 11th shooter.
I'm with you.
Which is the full expectation. So, unfortunate. And I think someone wrote a really good piece about it of like, Ole was actually probably the right manager for the job for a really long time. The question is, as he has changed the club for the better, right? They've reestablished themselves as one of the top two or three teams in England. They get to a couple finals and semifinals. Like, they are in a better place now than they were when he took over. The question now is, can he continue to elevate them? And I don't think there was evidence of that in this final. And if that's not the case, how does Man U handle this? How do you take a club legend who helped you rebuild the club and move on from there? Is there a way to like move him up into a technical role and bring in someone as a manager who maybe is a little bit more adventurous, has more ideas of how to set a team up and win big games like this? So I think it's an interesting time period for Man U because of that. And this was one for him to say, like, you guys are wrong. Like, I don't just come up big when my back's against the wall after a couple losses and I can like have specific ideas to help my team win a game like this. And I don't think he proved that.
He's sent out his Amazon wish list for players, which is like $500 million worth. So they have to make it
for Chelsea.
To go all in. I did. It did. Again, Harry Kane will definitely help them. I mean, yeah. ton of stuff happened over the last week. I'm going to do this relatively quickly, but please jump in if we really want to go into it. But Brentford is up to the Premier League. Say I have a few Swansea friends who I felt really bad for, but I do like to see some new blood in the top shelf, top flight. I know Brentford's been there before, but it's been a very long time. And the Bees were the cool club 7 years ago, I feel like. But then basically we're like the Leafs in these championship playoffs. So if they could do it, maybe there is some hope for us all. Antonio Conte at Inter parted ways after Inter won Serie A, which is not surprising at all. And that probably is the biggest indictment of what is happening with the musical chairs in Europe. It's absolutely insane. It's France, Italy, Germany, basically. A job opening could be there in the blink of an eye. But I guess what surprised you guys the most out of this whirlwind, which includes Pirlo getting sacked, Allegri coming back, Inzaghi to Napoli, Gattuso to Fiorentina, Zinedine Zidane quitting Real Madrid, Carlo Ancelotti probably replacing him. Which one has stood out to you guys?
So I think we did pretty extensively the musical chairs in Germany that was going on, right? Everyone became available. Nagelsmann moved. That set off a chain reaction. Marco Rose, Jesse Marsh, all of this stuff. And I was like, this is absurd. And now this, 2 weeks later, is more absurd than all of this. What's the most mind-blowing to me is Allegri, because the fact that one of these clubs would go back like that. It's not that he's changed as a manager. He literally hasn't managed. Nothing has changed, and yet they're bringing it back. And obviously, we're hearing the rumors of Pochettino and discussions with Tottenham at the same time, which I don't believe, because I can't believe it. Because again, I don't understand how this happens with Allegri. Why would he not have been the manager last year then? Like, what are you doing if this is your decision And Massimo Allegri is a good manager. He's proven that. I don't think he's someone I would put to take a team to put them together and build from the bottom. But I know that if you give him some pretty good pieces, he can do enough with it to compete and win championships and go to Champions League finals and all this stuff. So that's the one that blows my mind the most, in the same way that Ancelotti's going to get the job again at Real Madrid. And like Zidane's going to go somewhere. He'll be back at Real Madrid in a year and a half. He said in one of his quotes leaving, like, you can't be a manager of a big time club for more than 2 years. And I think we're sort of seeing the evidence of that. Like, Pep continues to win, but also pumps in money. We've seen for Klopp the up and down experience that it's been. And I think he's at a club and has a personality where everyone's going to stick with him. But at the same time, you could see how he could be gone already and might be gone quite soon.
And Zizou's probably like, he's talking mentally as well. I imagine it's just ridiculously taxing to be hyper analyzed by like this at all times. And like, it's justified because you are the manager of this club and people just consider it normal. I could see how that would be pretty messed up.
And remember, right? Pep left Barca after 3 years, left Bayern after 3 years. And all of that was, he put so much into it that he couldn't. Now I've heard that he's kind of a little less intense at Man City, and maybe also the financial stability they have allows him to be. But that, as you're saying, that just shows like it's almost impossible. I mean, if Zidane can't do it at Real Madrid, where he's like sort of not even coaching, but still winning Champions Leagues and is a god at the club and in the game, then I don't know that anyone can.
Does Zizou go anywhere else?
I think it's France. It would upset me if Deschamps held on, and we'll see what this tournament looks like. But I think there's a, as we're seeing with Yogi Love, like there's a limit to the way a team will react to a manager over and over. And what I'm seeing from the Karim Benzema move and some of the others coming into this tournament is like Deschamps going back to people he trusts rather than giving the next generation an opportunity. And obviously Mbappe started in the World Cup final, so the next generation is already there for a lot of parts of it. So I would like to see him take over France. And I think it would be really cool for him to kind of like try and do what he couldn't do, which is follow up a World Cup with continued success.
Dang. I mean, there's other stuff too. Magnan from Lille to Milan. Donnarumma's gone from Milan. Konate's to Arsenal, but he's suspended for a year, so who the hell cares? Konate, Nick, congratulations.
Thank you.
A lot of stuff's happening, and it will continue to happen, because though no one has money, I guess, people are going to make moves, and they probably will be shadier than we've ever seen them before. So stay tuned when we come back to wrap up this week's show. It's the Mailbag Ask AFE coming up next.
Welcome back, and it's now time for everyone's favorite segment, Ask AFP. Thanks to everyone who sent their questions this week. If you didn't get the chance to send in your own question, just hop on Twitter and use the hashtag AskAFP and send them our way. Our first question goes to our ever-reliable Matt V, and he asks, why is UEFA so stubborn as to play the Champions League final at the same time as three MLS games? Come on, guys.
The hubris, right? UEFA thinking they can go up against TFC Crew is pretty pretty huge. But I have to imagine, after the week that it was for TFC, they didn't mind playing at the exact same time as the Champions League final. I think they were okay with that.
I saw someone say it best on Twitter, which was, the worst part about MLS games being played at the same time is the MLS players don't get to watch the Champions League final. Because you know they're all fans of those teams.
Yeah, for sure.
Is that a mistake on the MLS part for scheduling these games? It feels like very NHL, where the NHL just schedules games randomly during NFL times and whatnot.
I think the long weekend probably forced some hands here in terms of when they put the game. Like, if they, I don't know if you could even put it on Sunday, or like TV rights as well, and who controls what. So
I also think, as huge as the Champions League final is, like, there's some crossover. It's not pure crossover,
right?
Weirdly.
Right.
And they're different. Watching on TV, 100%. But like, okay, are you going to go to this game or are you going to watch the Champions League final? Going to a game is a different experience. So there's a level of people that will go. The other thing is, with this year and COVID and international breaks and all that stuff, they're just throwing games in wherever they want. Like, I don't think there's, I don't think that there is that 18th stage of planning even available to them just because of the situations you're in.
Gary asks, why is there such a debate on Trent Alexander-Arnold?
Ooh, Devang, you go first. I want to hear you.
Well, I think if you haven't been following, TAA is up against Reece James, Kyle Walker, and Kieran Trippier for that right back spot on Gareth Southgate's England, but it seems like Trent will be left out. We are recording this within seconds, probably, of the squad coming out, but it sounds like he's not going to make the team. I mean, it's a huge debate within England and like the Premier League as well, because I think you have some direct comparisons with James and Walker, but to me, it's like you take him and you probably leave Walker at home, but I think Southgate probably wants some quote-unquote veteran experience alongside a young team that will be featured. I don't know. I think Liverpool-wise, Nick, like, people seem to be pretty mad about this, but rightfully so. He had a good year. Just, I guess, the narrative and the expectations were a bit higher.
It's a weird one because, I mean, even like Aaron Wan-Bissaka, he's not even in this conversation. Yeah. Yeah. He's a great right back. There's a lot of depth in that position for the team, but I feel like at the end of the day, this is not Liverpool bias here. He is a world-class player offensively. He might not be there yet defensively, but I still think he's a heck of a player defensively, and he was for Liverpool this season. But if I'm Gareth Southgate, you have to make room for this kid because he is world-class and he creates chances better than anyone else on that team. And for me, it's like, maybe you don't have a spot for him, but he's got to be somewhere on that team that maybe you can slot him in somewhere, even off the bench or something. And maybe even he doesn't even play, but to leave him off entirely, I think is completely disrespectful to him.
Yeah, Nick, the only thing I would say is while he is a world-class player going forward, he doesn't play both ways. And if that's not what England are going to use, then you can understand he's more specific than everyone else in this team. Aaron Wan-Bissaka also has been borderline world-class defending, has not been a plus player going forward. As you said, doesn't get on this team. So you're looking at a team with options that can go both ways. And if you're Gareth Southgate and that's how you're going to play, then it seems like, okay, why would I not bring a player who can like for like sub at this position for what I'm going to start? I assume Kieran Trippier is the starter. Think he's been the best right back in the world over the last season. And then you've got Reece James, as we talked about, and Kyle Walker as well can go in there. So it seems like that kind of is what's hurting Trent Alexander-Arnold. It's shocking to say that because of how important he was to Liverpool and how important he has been to England when he's played in big games. But again, I think the Liverpool setup fits him very specifically, and it's a different setup here. Either way, it's like an incredible issue for England to have and one that they definitely have not had for a really long time.
Finally, Vic asks, Brazil is taking over Copa America 13 days before the tournament. How do you think this tournament is going to play out, guys?
Probably the same as the last one in Brazil, which was zero fans there. Not the respect that this tournament deserves because CONMEBOL shoves it down people's throat every opportunity they get. And it'll be a bit of a letdown. So this is, I think, the fourth time they're doing this tournament in 5 years. No, maybe it's the fourth in 6 years. And there's just like no getting away from the fact that I understand for CONMEBOL, this is how they make money to fund the game in their region. But the mismanagement at the top level of how it comes about and who gets opportunities to do it, aka anything that's not corrupt, clearly is lacking. And that's made the game, I think, worse in the region. You're seeing all the protests going on from a political point of view across South America. And I think it's a frustration with this like old corrupt ruling class. And I think the sport also goes in line with that.
It's well said. I think between this and the Olympics, it's a competition for most ill-advised holding of an international event this summer. It's like, I don't know what the hell is going on. Well, I do know that the TV money is gigantic. And I'm sure interests like that are involved in Copa America. And this, like you said, just slapdash approach to holding an international competition during a pandemic where the cases in South America are incredibly high and they had to move it because of that. So it's a mess. It's an absolute mess. Hopefully everyone is safe as can be and they pull it off. And I mean, at this point, who the hell knows? So par for the course, basically.
It's just a weird scenario, especially with all the protests going on. It's like there's literally two sides of what's going on. Like there's so many problems. And it's like, here, let's play some more football.
Yeah.
When in doubt, play some games. Play some games. Which seems to be the MO of everyone the last year or so. But at the end of the seasons in Europe, seeing those fans back was so huge, though. Like, I don't think I could go another season with empty stands. It's such a huge difference.
Can I rant on one thing, actually?
Please. That's okay. Keep it tight.
I love seeing fans in these stadiums, but every time they, you know, the announcers like shove it down our throats that like these people are heroes almost, where it's like, oh, doesn't it feel so good that these fans are back? It's like, I don't know. It just seems weird to me also.
Interesting. I think it's more of a like, the way I've taken it is like, oh, like we sort of, for some people, made it through this and it's like nice to be out the other side.
But I feel like that's kind of how it's felt. Fully gone the other side. That's why it feels weird to me.
That's 100% fair. I think that's been the feeling around like the NBA playoffs when I've been watching it.
I was going to say that the NBA playoffs, like you're seeing fans come back and act like complete morons, which I think is like an interesting, like people are in public society now and do not know how to control themselves, which is a terrifying development.
You guys.
That you can stew over. Yeah.
I went away last week because we've like, gotten our vaccine. It's been 2 weeks. Like, okay, let's get out and try and do something. And it was like 20 minutes into the airport where I turned and looked at my girlfriend. I was like, all right, we've been inside for a year and a half. I forgot everyone's an idiot. On the lowest functional level. So yeah, we're back, baby. We're back.
It's a beautiful game. It's a beautiful game. All right. That's it for another episode of AFP. A reminder, a rating, or a review of this podcast, wherever you get it, would be incredible for us. We're also on Twitter at A Football Pod, as well as on patreon.com/AFootballPodcast. A hearty welcome back to Mr. Dylan Wilson, engineering the show on the ones and twos. Welcome back, Dill. And for Nick, David, and myself, thank you so much for listening to AFP. We'll talk to you next week.